I think I'll start. You mentioned that God's mercy crushes the walls of division in Jesus's conversation, teaching there. And that, I mean, this is not the only portion that we see in the Hebrew Bible or New Testament, right, where we're kind of talking about the aspect. One of the things that's mentioned occasionally in the Gospels is that that the only sign that will be given the generation is the sign of Jonah. And Jonah is a prophet who gives, a very reluctant prophet, who gives a message that there will be judgment and then only sees God's mercy. He doesn't want God's mercy to fall upon his enemies, right? To be very succinct in the quick response. What do you think the sign of Jonah is?
So I can tell you how Flusser dealt with it. First of all, that saying comes in slightly different forms and different ones, that the sign that will be given to this generation is the sign of Jonah. In Jewish tradition, the sign of repentance was actually the prophet. God would send him as the sign for them to repent. It isn't talking about necessarily what happened with Jonah and his message, but it's the fact that the prophet himself becomes God's sign to the generation to repent. And that's how I would read it. I wouldn't take it too far along that Jonah and the whole story there, but just the line that just as Jonah was assigned to this to his generation, the Son of Man will be assigned to his generation. Okay?
Because I think how it's most typically interpreted is just like Jonah was in the belly of the big fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man too will be in the...
That's, Matthew takes right. It there. Luke does not. So that's, there were all kinds of very interesting things, because not all the Gospels read identically. And then we're left to ask the question, what are they doing? What are the evangelists doing in their different versions? And can we, when we have differences, can we get back mm-hmm. to what Jesus might have said? But it's two different forms there. But Matthew does take it to talk about as a sign of the resurrection. Three days and three nights. And, anyhow, that's a whole other
series
of questions with no answers.
When you were talking about how there's this message of mercy that's dividing these walls, crushing these walls of division, the first prophet that came to mind is this prophet Jonah, right? That because I've heard others suggest that maybe the sign of Jonah, other than the 3 days and three nights that Jesus might be referring to, is that Gentiles are coming in and that this mercy is being extended to people beyond just the covenant people of Israel.
I get it. I mean, a lot of commentaries take the episode we just read in Nazareth about the widow of Zarephath and Naaman as to suggest the Gentile mission. I don't think that's really Jesus's focus then. I think that, at least in my reading of it, he makes the statement, I came but for the house of Israel. That doesn't mean that it doesn't eventually make its way there, but I think Jesus focused on his community, his people. I mean, we have encounters with non-Jews. We have the man, the legion of demons, who actually tried to follow Jesus, and Jesus sent him back. So said, you know, go tell your people what God has done for you. And so I think for Jesus and his ministry, he was primarily focused on his own people, with the understanding that through them all the nations will be blessed. And I think that's why when we read in the book of Acts, they're not particularly comfortable with the coming in of the Gentiles. And so I think that tells us that this is something fresh, new, revelatory in the book of Acts. And we read the Great Commission that to every man, woman, and child. But if that's the case, everybody has that understanding, then you know the first half of Acts is a bit of a mystery. And instead, I think what we find is that we have this tension going. I love the book of Acts. It's a book on faith and culture. How do we integrate faith? And those are questions we still grapple with as the church, as people today. How do we, to use Paul's words, how do we live in the world and not be of it? And it's a tricky question. And I think you're watching it in the book of Acts. But part of that is, I think, the coming in of the Gentiles for some is a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, when it happens, when Peter has the vision, the dream, he's like, this is going to be an issue, right? This is going to be complicated. Yeah. And it's funny, talking about the person who's delivered from the legion, right? Jesus says, stay there. I think I've always been taught it's because he had a mission there. He had an apostolic, like he was going to be the one sent to that community. And the next time Jesus shows up, there's a bunch of people waiting for him, right? But I wonder if instead it's just like, listen, it's going to be too complicated to include you, Gentile, with all these pigs in this group of 12 Jews right now. We'll talk about this in another book.
No, I think he met the needs he encountered. He did not, he didn't draw the line when the people came to him in need, whether they were Jew or Gentile. He met those needs. But I think also he balanced out the cultural sensitivity. The fact that that whole Eastern Shore, the reason they're raising pigs, those are all Gentiles. That area in the Decapolis on the Eastern Shore of the Sea of Galilee are non-Jews. And I don't think it's a coincidence, now we're to historical geography, that whole story happens after a storm. They're blown off course, they come into safe harbor, and suddenly the story unfolds. I don't think that area is normal terrain for them. And they encountered the man and sent him back. And so, but I think that's it's an interesting question looking at Jesus and grappling with issues of the cultural, ethnic distinctions. I'll mention one more and then you can do some more questions. But one of the fascinating stories is when they're coming up through Samaria and a Samaritan village would not allow them to go through. Because those were competing national identities. And the Samaritans did not want their village to be used as a road going up affirming Jerusalem when they had another place at Gerizim. And so they wouldn't allow him to come through. What did the disciples say? Do you want us to call fire from heaven? In other words, scorched earth because they won't be receiving. And Jesus turns around and rebukes them. Says, you don't know whose children you are. Jesus did not allow those distinctions to spill over into dehumanizing other individuals. He respected the cultural contours, but not to the extent of dehumanizing other individuals. I think it's a very nice, it's a pointed story. Yep.
All right, I'm going to have one more question, then the rest of you get ready. Do we already have another question already? Go ahead. My question was simply going to be, why do you think Jesus is able to walk through the crowd at the end of this incident in Luke 4?
It's a new one for me. I actually have an answer, which doesn't always happen. Again, I'll tell you that I've written on this account, I've written in peer review, but each I come back to it, it's like layers. There's no end to this story. There's things, and I finally have, at least for me, I feel like I'm in the process. It's one of the reasons when I was asked, Danielle asked about speaking, I said, this is something I'm chewing on right now. Would you mind if I sort of chewed on it in front of the congregation? Because I'm processing it. I hope you've heard that I work both as a scholar, but also as a person of deep faith. This stuff impacts me, and I don't always measure up, but I try to allow it to shape my thinking. But I was grappling with this question, and you'll read a multitude of answers as to why he walks through and they don't touch, and especially when you have the story of Choni, the circle drawer, and they stone him. I've never encountered anybody who uses the story of Choni and this idea of preference as a backdrop to the story in Nazareth. But it had the same violent end, in a sense. They take him out to do him in, and then he just walks away. And about a year or so ago, I was talking to a couple of Jewish scholars, friends of my top guys, and so I sent off a question. I couldn't find anyone there. I said, when does it become Jewish practice to forbid execution on the Sabbath? And they said, Second Temple period. This is not an Old Testament concept. This is a developing. So I wrote them back, and they all thought I was wanting to talk about Jesus and the passion narrative, and the you know what's going on there. And I said, "Come on, guys, this is a student of David Flusser's. It's the Romans who killed Jesus, not the Jews." And I said, "I'm talking about something else." But both of them said that, and so I've done the research on it, and it seems that this episode is one of the earliest references we have to the forbidding of execution on the Sabbath. And they can't touch him. The reason the stories end differently, the story of Choni is not on Shabbat. The story of Nazareth is on Shabbat. I think it's very simple. They can't follow through because they are forbidden from executing on Shabbat.
All right.
You may like it, you may not like it. That would be my...
Turn the gem. Okay, questions from the community. I'm going to walk a mic around. Yes.
So where does the prohibition against execution on the Sabbath arise? Is it because it's work or what?
Because it's what?
Work.
No, there are certain limitations. They put strictures on certain aspects of the death penalty execution, and this is one that develops during the Second Temple period. It's that we have references to the forbidding of putting someone to death. There are various means of execution, but forbidding to do that on Shabbat. And so this is all part of, again, part of developing Jewish practice that we get hints of in the New Testament, I think for the first time. And this is another one, I believe, that is, it's the earliest evidence we have of the, it's implied, okay? It doesn't tell us that that's why, but it's the only explanation I have as to why they just let him walk off. They take him out to throw him over, which is to stone him, and he just walks through. And the only explanation I can think of is this idea of the developing idea of forbidding execution on Shabbat. He's going to ask a hard one. I know.
No,
I see it coming.
So, Steve, you make a very strong argument for how the grace and mercy that Jesus extends consistently baffles those who would put strictures against those who make it and those who don't, those who qualify and those who don't. It seems that there is sometimes an evangelical obsession with a similar question of who's going to qualify, who's going to make it or not. So my question is there a cohesive argument to be made on the basis of Jesus' insistence on breaking barriers for Christian universalism?
For Christian?
Universalism.
I don't know that I would, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I don't know that I would, I guess I would take it in a different direction, this thing of mercy, is understanding. I generally talk to my students, and I usually have a chalkboard, so it makes it easier, but I have a triangle, and it's God, us, and you. Okay? Me and you and God in this triangular relationship, and we're called to treat each other in the way that we want God to treat us. You prayed a prayer. You don't realize how dangerous that prayer is. Forgive us our sins, just as we forgive. That is the, and it's a very much a Jewish concept of this triangulation. To the one who extends mercy will receive mercy. If you don't, it's the crux of the story to the woman caught in adultery. Let him, and I'll give the amplified version, let him who has no need of mercy judge without mercy to the woman. They all walked away because all of us stand in a place of needing God's mercy, God's forgiveness, and the that sort of Jewish concept of this triangulation, I think, is what's in his thing of his proclamation of mercy. I don't know that, I mean, my reading of it, I don't read Jesus as a universalist. I think I read, if I understood the question right, yeah. I think he does talk about, there are a number of parables in which it talks about judgment postponed. Usually the elements, the imagery for judgment is division, is separation, is one of them, and the like the story of the tares, the planting of the tares in there, and people want to come and pull them out. By the way, the language of all of that comes very close to John's message. And Flusser actually thought that that was a rebuke of John's. John was one who wanted judgment now. I think this is why he sent Jesus a question. You know, are you the one who is to come, or is there another? Where's judgment? Or the righteous are still suffering here. The wicked are up having a party. And I'm about ready to lose my head, by the way. And so, but in the story of the, they want to come in and pull up the tares out of the wheat. It says, no, wait till the harvest, and then they'll be separated out. Also, the saying, the parable of the saying, I don't think Jesus rejected the idea of eventual separation. I think he recognized that evil is real. It exists. But I think his message for those who encountered is to be very careful in our exchanges with each other, because in the measure that we judge, in the measure that we forgive, we'll be judged, we'll be forgiven. It's a very, very Jewish concept of this triangulation. It's also quite, if you start thinking about it, think of the people that you've not forgiven. Think of the people that you've judged. I think it's a call to us to be exercising. That's what he says: be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful. But I don't read, in my reading of it, I don't read him suggesting that there won't be judgment at all. I think judgment postponed, I think, is there are developing ideas of God's mercy, divine mercy. And these grew out of the Antiochian persecutions with the Maccabees, Antiochus Epiphanes, and people did not know how to deal with that because the righteous were being martyred and the wicked were living long lives. That's not how it's supposed to work. And it's different than the Old Testament message where you're suffering because of your sin. Now they're suffering because they refuse to sin. If you know the story of the Maccabees and that episode. But out of it, there develops a crisis of faith. They realize that either, there are only a few choices. Either God is impotent and can't stop all of this unrighteous suffering. God is complicit in it. He's somehow involved in the fact that the righteous are suffering and the wicked are living long lives, or this demonstrates God's unfathomable mercy to the extent that, and they develop out of that, within Jewish thinking, the second century BC and onwards, developing ideas, a greater appreciation of humanity, of others, that they're created in God's image. Again, this is when we first began to hear the idea that we're all created in God's image, and and ethics flow out of that. But I don't, again, for me, in my reading, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I don't read that there's no judgment. I think that I don't find Jesus contradicting others in that time regarding that there won't be any judgment at all, there won't be any punishment at all. What that looks like, what it entails, that is another question altogether. But there does seem to be within Jesus' message, there is a time of judgment, there is a time of division, separation.
One that comes to mind is just Matthew 25, with the separation of the sheep and the goats. There is a judgment, right? And it's still, so to move Jesus into universalism would have to, you'd have to deal with these other passages where he is talking about a judgment that's happening.
I think Jesus' caution is be careful thinking that you can decide who the sheep and the goats are. That's the caution. Is that there? You know, I leave that in God's hands. There may, you know, that it's not up to me to judge as to, and we all, you know, we encounter people with different journeys, different going through different things. I think it's a word to us to be very slow and careful in our judgment of their journeys.
But I think one takeaway at least is, but if you see somebody hungry, you better feed them.
Yes.
So yeah. there is an action expected from the people who are faithful.
Because as often as you've done it to them.
That's right.
You've done it to him.
Or
we're
not.
Back at the triangulation.
Exactly.
Again.
Yeah. Is there another question? We have a mic back there we can pass along. Yes, right here, Joseph.
So, how are you? So it was brought to my attention, you know, what caught my attention was the vengeance and the wrath of God.
Yes.
Right? And then I went to a different sermon today, and they talked about Genesis and Adam and Eve and how God basically, you know, inflicted pain and death as punishment that you were disobedient towards. Da, da, da. And then they quoted something about Romans, right? I mean, where does the belief system itself come from? Hmm? You know, that where does the belief system itself come from that God is, you know, that God has vengeance and, you know, fear your God and the wrath of God? I mean, it was put in the Garden of Eden, right? When they were expelled and, you know, pain and death will follow you, right? And I know Genesis 2 or something, right? And where does the belief system again from, you know, that there should be, you know, or that there was, you know, like wrath and vengeance from the beginning, right? And then, you know, where did that, you know, good old, went over that, okay, it's not the case. It's, you know, I mean, it's God is merciful. God comes in a whisper. God comes, you know, not, you know, with a mighty storm and stuff, but, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, to the point, not mercy, not mentioning the vengeance and the wrath and, you know, of course, you know, the might of God. So
I mean, I guess the only way I could respond to that is that sometimes in some Christian circles, you'll hear them contrast, you know, the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament, and that misses the point. And that is, I think that Jesus belongs to developments in his time. He very much reflects ideas that are developing in the second, first century BC AD, and reflects those in his teaching, part of emerging Jewish humanism. Again, some of these ideas you don't find in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament. They are developments, and he's right in the thick of it. And in my opinion, at times gives the greatest clarity or voice to those. He's not unique, but he gives an incredible clarity to those. So I think they're different. That's all I can tell you. I think
there's a reference to Romans.
What? Oh, Romans. Paul's a different kettle of fish.
Paul is a different kettle.
Let's leave Paul aside tonight. But no, I hear what you're saying. At times, yeah. I mean, I hear you. Paul sometimes is drawing on threads from the, but he's also dealing in a very different setting. He's dealing in the Gentile world and the taking of the gospel to the Gentiles in the Greco-Roman world. So, but I mean, what I've been focused on this evening is trying to grapple with where is Jesus in the landscape of Jewish thinking, and what should our attitude be towards people that we are around, and how do we reflect God's mercy in our lives and our speech, our actions. Is there another question?
Yeah.
Save me.
I very much enjoyed the way you interpreted the prophet, where he goes home and he's either disrespected or you're not going to win loyal followers at home, and you turned it into, it was a mission. He was supposed to go help somebody else. My question to you is, I'm sure there's all kinds of those great findings in the Bible. What are some, one or two that you think are more than just interesting that are very important that maybe we as a church, big church, are not getting right in terms of interpretation?
Everything is right in this church. I want to get invited back. As I've tried to explain, I mean, I have looked at this text and I come to it again and again. There's no end of the depth and the richness. And I don't claim that my handling of it is absolutely correct either. I think for me, I'm trying to think what, one, I'm a historical geographer, so there's all kinds of little jewels and nuggets and things in terms of what we find there physically describing the story. I think there are things, I think the greatest thing, and I think this church is probably has its finger on the pulse, is immersing yourself in the culture, the language, because language is culture. I mean, people, you know, it's not that Hebrew is heavenly, although it is in Jewish tradition, but I mean, it's the fact that, you know, it's the language culture of Jesus, so at times we miss things. I taught for many years in New York City in an urban setting, and my students were all multilinguals, and they would understand. Immediately, I start talking about language and culture, and I say, what happens when you tell a Spanish joke in English? And they all start laughing, because you can't tell a Spanish joke in English. And then and I said, so imagine where we are. Jesus is saying things in Hebrew, it gets translated into Greek, and then we translate into Spanish, English, German, whatever. Think of all the things that get missed. I don't know. I'm sort of...
I'll see if I'm reframing your question, yeah. Tom. Like the capital C, do you want to say church in the United States of America? Capital C church. What are one or two things that you think, or if you could like send a memo that would be read by all pastors in North America, yeah. Right? And that they would read it and listen to it. What are one or two things that we should know or we're missing that we don't know about the person and teachings of Jesus that would maybe change how we live our daily lives as Christians in this country?
That's what I said.
Okay. Is that what you're asking? Did I get it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you can ponder it if you want to think on it too, and we can see if there's any other questions. Because that's a great big question.
It's a great question. Look, I tell people that what I do is driven by John 1:14. The Word became flesh. And that our faith is not a philosophy. It has philosophical trappings, but it's part of history. God stepped into culture, God in reality, and that it's important for us to approach it in that way, as limited as we can. I mean, not everybody has the luxury of living 16 years in Israel. But I think that we can sort of try to understand something of that, or at least be sensitive to it. That it's that Jesus is part of a culture. He's engaging. He's challenging it. I guess I'm struck all the time by the parallels. He lived in a time of oppression and social injustice, yearning for freedom, for liberty. People with all kinds of ideas of how that could be accomplished, and he navigated those. Some he didn't accept everyone, every idea, but he challenged those. I think he spoke to power. We're not talking tonight about the passion narrative. We're in the season of Lent right now that ends, and unfortunately, I think we don't always understand why Jesus was handed to the Romans and who was about it. $50 for anybody who can find the Pharisees and the and the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. Pharisees are not there, and yet we see them as the enemies of Jesus. Instead, it's the priestly aristocracy who have a vested interest in the status quo. I don't know if I'm resonating with things that we deal with, speaking to power. And I think he could say what he wants on the hillside in Galilee, but when he came and did that in the center of power in Jerusalem, in the temple, all the same names pop up there. So I think it's important when we read, I think Jesus boldly challenged the corruption. If you were with me, we would go walking in the Jewish quarter. We'd go through priestly homes, 5,500 square feet. I don't know how big your house is, but that's bigger than mine, and decorated to the hilt. These were the homes of high priests. And so this was the priestly aristocracy, and they were not suffering under the occupation. So when Jesus comes into Jerusalem, he challenges the corruption. And I think sometimes all of our movies, the Cecil B. DeMille's films, all those kinds of, we think of, 10,000 people crying, crucify him, crucify him. It cannot happen, would not happen. In Jewish tradition, to hand a fellow Jew over to someone and it leads to their death is considered an unforgivable sin. It cannot happen. Only those who don't believe that there's a world to come, the Sadducees, the priests that we're talking about, would be susceptible to such a thing. So I think all in all, in terms of Jesus' message, I think he spoke to the yearnings and the hope of the people of his time, of his generation. But I don't think he shied away from challenging corruption and oppression. I don't think the people of Jerusalem rejected Jesus. I think just the opposite. He was taken quietly out of sight. Remember what he says? I was with you day after day in the temple, and you didn't dare lay a hand on me. There's a refrain all through the Passion narrative that what they do, they have to do in secret out of being seen, because I think the people hung on his word. Not that they're believers, but because he was speaking to the inequities, the corruption that was going on. And ultimately, I think that's what led to his demise, being handed over. I mean, I think in the grand scheme of things, of course, there's a great theological drama going on. But I think historically, and I try to communicate that to my students, I said, we all know that I'm responsible for the death of Jesus. Okay, my sin took him to the cross. But historically, it's important for us to define what actually happened, because as we know, there are still, to this day, in our day, people on the televisions, on the talking heads, are talking about the Jews killing Jesus. And it's important for us to not only to hear Jesus' message clearly, what he is saying, the important things he is doing and saying, but also what's not going on, which has been distorted, unfortunately, 2,000 years of church history. So, sorry.
No, that was perfect. So if I'm summing up, I'm going to say reading Jesus in his historical, cultural context and linguistic context, right? So at that point, then we're looking at where is he, when is he, what text is he echoing, referring to, hinting to, quoting directly? What are the other power systems that are in place? What are the people group that are in place? And that when we start to read him into his culture, we're less likely to misread him into ours.
Yeah. And it's a lifelong process. It never ends. I was telling yesterday why I went to study with Flusser, and I went over for 1 month to listen to him, and one of the students challenged him on how he was reading a text. And he says, 2 years ago you explained it this way, now you explain it that way. And he said, this time he was well into his 60s, and he says, I hope a man my age is still permitted to learn. And I think I don't think we should ever, every time, I was taught to open and read it fresh every time, and to see what you discover, what you've missed, and I think there's a whole process there, but yeah.
Yeah, New Testament scholar Tom Wright, I've heard him often start his messages by saying, I just want to start by letting you know one-third of everything I'm going to tell you tonight isn't true. The problem is I don't know which one-third it is,
right? Yeah.
So if we start from some place of humility and continued learning, I think that's also another aspect that remains deeply important. And I think the Jewish rabbinic of sort of turning the gem, there's 70 faces to every text. Great, you have discovered one. You have a lifetime. You know, you're bragging because you've learned Torah. Don't brag about that. It's for what you're made for. All of these things we've talked about for many years here at Spark. And I think that that humility to come into the text and ask questions of it, but also be asked questions ourselves of the text is a very Jesus thing to do.
Very much.
Other questions, comments regarding any of this, including who is David Flusser? I mean, most Christians.
Who is David Flusser?
Who is David Flusser?
Wow. he was a Czech Jew who escaped the Holocaust, made his way to Jerusalem. He said that Greek saved his life, and Jesus saved his Jewish identity. He got out in 1939 because he knew Greek. He trained as a philologist, as a linguist, and he was allowed into British Palestine, a British mandate Palestine, to teach Greek at Hebrew University, so he escaped the Holocaust. And he was introduced as a young man by a Mennonite to Jesus, to the teaching of Jesus. Flusser wanted to read everything that had ever been written in antiquity by Jews. So he read everything. He was a voracious reader. So he read the whole New Testament and spent time talking back and forth, sort of question and response, to this Mennonite, which is nice because he always said the Mennonites understand the ethics of Jesus and the requirements. But he read and understood. He said, when I read the words of Jesus, I understood that I was still obligated to the law. He grew up in a completely, totally secular home, absolutely off the charts. And when he, after he read, he became Baal Tshuva. He became a repentant Jew, which is a very unusual thing because there was no separation between Jesus and his Jewish identity. They were all sort of intermingled together, whereas a lot of times Jewish scholars feel a need to keep a little bit of space, which I get, I appreciate, but with Flusser, it was never like that. And there was a very interesting integration of those things. He was a brilliant scholar, considered the finest Jewish scholar of Second Temple period Judaism and early Christianity. You would be shocked at some of the things. I mean, when I worked with him on the historical biography of Jesus, the book was just called Jesus, published by Magnus Press, Hebrew University Press. When we came to the resurrection, Flusser writes, there can be no doubt that Jesus rose from the dead. I said, Flusser, prof, you can't write that. I mean, that would be a huge problem. So we had to craft the sentence in such a way that you could, as he says, you're making me sound like a medieval Jew, you know, that you sort of read it in a lot of different ways. But he wasn't a Christian. You know, he used to say, I hope you don't deny me of this just because I lack a little water. But he was an extraordinarily extraordinary scholar, extraordinary person. And I would have to say someone who really loved Jesus. I hope I communicate that idea well. Passionate about understanding. He felt like that Jesus many times gave us the clearest understanding of what the Father intends for us, how we should live our lives. And so it was a privilege to study with him, to be there. It wasn't easy, but it was good. He died in 2000, So he's been gone a while, and but it still, you can still see generations of scholars who take his scholarship and feed on it and are still understanding the implications of it. So.
And you worked with him on more than one book, or you've helped publish, if you could share
the
books. The
book, Jesus, and then it came out. There were three. He was always adding chapters. That's how he was. There was always an extra chapter. We did in 97, 98, 99. Each year there was a new edition with a new chapter. And then he passed away. And he always had wanted a paperback. You're probably talking about The Sage from Galilee. There was an American publisher. There was an American scholar and an American publisher that was going to publish the book. And I'll just say they were going to butcher the book and do things to it that Flusser would have never, ever allowed. There were all kinds of content of it he would have been. And then the publisher, then they found out that there was another person, name on the title page, who was still alive. So they came to me and said, can you, and I said, only if I can restore it to its, and so then we published it. Flusser always wanted it as a paperback. It's called The Sage from Galilee, still available if you want to be challenged a bit in your reading. But it's put out by Erdmann's. And so it was, but we renamed it The Sage from Galilee. And so that's probably why the confusion. I only did one work with Flusser.
And then there's a recent work that was just translated that's by Flusser, right? The Rabbinic Parables and Jesus, the Parable Teller, which is also available.
I'm big into parables. Are you in my class?
I'm in your class.
Okay, all right. So
my camera's off tonight.
I'm teaching an online course. I'm never quite sure who's coming and going on the screens there. I'm teaching a course on parables. I got involved in parables many years ago, and the one of the things I regretted, one of Flusser's most important works was a work on Jesus, the parables of Jesus and rabbinic parables. It was done in German. It's considered very influential, very important work, but it had never been translated into English. So I had a student of mine who was part of a German-speaking community in upstate New York, and who, after studying with me, went on to Princeton and then now is finishing his doctorate at Hebrew University. And so Tim and I used to go online in Zoom and read this work and slowly work through a translation, very rough. And then Tim, because he's fluent in German, I encouraged and arranged for him to translate the work into English, and so it was published 2 years ago. It had not been published since 1981. It had been in German only, and so in the German-speaking world or scholarly world, people knew it, but not in the not here in America. So now it's available. Yeah.
We have time for one more question, and then I just want to say, if you want to ever sit into one of Dr. Notley's classes, you can audit your courses through Jerusalem University. You don't even have to turn in a paper if you don't want to. You can sit, right? I'm not turning in a paper. But
That's news to me.
Every year I take the opportunity to sit and continue to listen in to the scholars that are coming out of Jerusalem University, and you have the opportunity to do that too. So one last question, if there's one available. All right.
This is sort of a semi-JUC, I will say that in May, June, I'm going to do a six-week thing on Bethsaida, on the discovery of Bethsaida, six weeks, 1 hour each evening. And then in the autumn, they've been after me for years doing this. In the autumn, tentatively, we're doing a course on New Testament historical geography. Amazing. And no one who deals in historical geography deals in the New Testament. They only do Old Testament. So this is a rather novel approach. But that's my passion, is the land and New Testament. So, okay.
Super fun. I have one last question then. If you were having a fanciful moment of thinking to yourself, what Torah portion would have been read? That Luke 4 passage when Jesus shows up, have you considered at all what portion or portions you think might be contenders?
Yes. I encountered some scholar in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, like you know, 1915, 19. I have to dig it out somewhere. The Torah portion goes with the Yom Kippur, and there is the suggestion that this is actually that Luke 4 takes place on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and that it's the Torah portion dealing with that. And that's the, you know, the Isaiah 58 particularly is speaking, you know, is this the fast I've chosen? And it somebody off the cuff suggested that, you know, perhaps this is Yom Kippur. And I actually, it's difficult because the... we just don't know, but I for me, that resonates well.
And Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement, right? It's a fast day for those of you who don't know. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. God bless you. Thank you. Thanks, all Sparkers. Stay around. We hope you come back and visit again.